So we are going to listen to three past presidents. First, Margaret Archer from Warwick University, UK. Then Alberto Martinelli, Milano, Italy. And Piotr Stonka, Kraków, Poland. And then, as he tried to say, our friend, the past president, Fernando Henriqueta, also couldn't join us because he's a guest. And I'm personally very sorry for that. After all of them, I will try to present some final comments. So, Margaret, please.
Thank you. Thank you. No, I will stay here if everybody is content with this. So, good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm going to be speaking about the crisis and specifically about the relationship between sociology and the events of the last 2 years. Now, in 1990, which seems a long time ago, at the Madrid World Congress, we received a very long message from Peter Berger. And the message really was a long reproach, saying the Berlin Wall had just fallen. Why had sociologists not foreseen that this was coming? And even if they're the kind of sociologists who did not believe in prediction, why had they not given an after the event explanation? In other words, the silence of the sociologists. And I'm going to maintain that the same reproach can be made of our discipline, of ourselves, a mea culpa, in relation to the recession. And specifically to try and ask the question, why did we give so little attention to it in a professional sense? And why did we at the beginning, why did those sociologists who made comments and commentary, why did they accept the journalistic term, the credit crunch? Because nothing could be more misleading for a description of the recession that we have been through and in many ways are still going through. To call it a credit crunch is to imply that people have some kind of new human right to credit and that the absence of credit in itself is the major problem. Personally, I think this is to take a surface empirical phenomenon and confuse it with the underlying generative process that produced the crisis, of which shortage of credit was certainly not the most important thing. So what I want to dwell on is the way in which a lot of our sociological models, particularly of human actors, are ones that, in a sense, colluded with and collaborated with the context of the crisis that unfolded in terms of the way in which our discipline always migrates from being an academic discipline to being taken up by the press, by the media, into various kinds of public representations and popular consciousness. And so I want to argue that our general popular understandings and expectations were shaped by various models of how, I'm trying to avoid the phrase models man, because of its engendered nature, it's almost impossible to avoid because this is how the whole argument was developed. But these particular conceptions And so on the first overhead, I put up the argument in three stages, that sociology has endorsed models of the human being, and hence models of human agency, that are predominantly individualistic, although in very different ways, and that this kind of individualism is, in my view, one of the core features that prepared the ground for the crisis to take place. Secondly, that such individualistic models of man, the person, from them it's not possible to conceptualize a form of political organization or of political philosophy that would have been resilient, resistant to the rich protagonists of the events that took place in banking, or the acquiescence of the poorer participants who also played their part. In other words, these sorts of models serve to buttress the institutional political context which prevented the regulation of those financial excesses that resulted in the recession. And the third point is that generically, the majority of today's social theory has very few resources with which to conceive of a robust civil society or to conceive of a real civil economy. Robust in the sense that such a civil society and civil economy would have been able to resist the scenario that unfurled. In other words, we have been very short in late modernity of conceptualizations of how it could be not just so, but otherwise, to use Weber's formulation. What we've had instead have simply been, again, extrapolations of single factor, unilateral, empirical surface features which have nothing to do with the generative mechanisms that drove the crisis or drove the economies of the developed world in late modernity. So we've had these unifactorial characterizations, which are more journalism, sociological analysis, the information society, the knowledge society, risk society, liquid society, McDonaldized society, and one could go on forever. And they don't help. Now, what I'd like to do to begin with, but very briefly, because you're all familiar with them, is just to run through, as a reminder more than anything else, three of the most famous individualistic models that have gravitated from the academy into the media. So, first of all, we have our good old friend Homo economicus and his kinfolk. He has plenty. And I have argued in many places that the whole conception of economic man is hostile to human well-being, that it is a sort of traducing of what the human being is to talk of as just pursuing our individual preference schedules, hoping to become better off in terms of some rather indefinite and indeterminate future utils, working entirely by instrumental rationality, by means end reasoning, which has two defects. The first is that it disallows that we can be people who are motivated by something other than becoming better off. There is no room in this model for human concerns of the type that Harry Frankfurter called the importance of what you care. can be presented in terms of pursuit of one's maximizing or satisfying one's preference schedule. And yet, as part of the migration process, we have people like Gary Becker putting forward his economic approach, which I'd like to call the economic approach to everything, because as Becker's work has unfolded, he thinks we can use rational choice theory to account for our choice of partners, our choice of churches, our decisions to have children, why we take care of our old parents in their old age. All of these are given an entirely instrumental, rational explanation. So we visit our old parents because we hope to inherit from them, never because we care about them. And that always leads one to ask idiotic rational choice questions about perfectly understandable human behavior, such as why does somebody give their partner a present on their birthday? Not because he or she hopes to be a better off, but because this is expressive of how they care for their partner. It is an end in itself, an evaluation, positive, of their relationship. So, economic man becomes entirely atomistic. If everybody were like him, there would be no free giving, no voluntary creation of public goods. Nobody would pick up their own litter. Everybody would be a free rider. We would have no free giving, and we would have very little social solidarity. But you know him well, so I will do no more than introduce him. But secondly, we have another very popular figure, model, standing for the human being, Homo sociologicus, who is held to work by bureaucratic regulation. He is a direct heir of the Hobbesian belief that we would have chaos, we would have no coordinated action whatsoever, unless it were directed from above. And this notion that all forms of public order and coordination of public bodies is dependent upon what Hobbes himself called the sovereign, obviously is hostile to any notion of subsidiarity, of intermediary organizations and institutions that perform tasks that groups in society wish them to perform. So Homo sociologicus gives you a very passive actor unless his role is prescriptive. So this is role-taking, not role-making, in the good old terminology of sociology. And the dangers of this approach, I think, are very well illustrated by something that appeared in the British press this spring. So teachers, school administrators, school governors all have a very detailed role script. Necessarily, logically, no role script can cover every contingency. It didn't cover this particular one. What one needed, to cover the one I'm going to tell you about, was an active agent who could act spontaneously, creatively, and usefully in an emergency context. So this is an ordinary classroom in which a young boy suddenly suffers an asthmatic attack. He can't breathe. There is nothing in the teacher's daily routine schedule that prescribes what they should do under these circumstances. The teacher in question sent the boy out of the classroom into a corridor. Six other teachers saw him there having breathing difficulties. And the end of this very sad story is the boy died before anybody thought it was their real task to ring for medical help and an ambulance. Homosociologicus doesn't help us too much, nor does Homo acorpium inconstantus, the inconstant man agent, who came into being with Giddens's thought circa early 90s, where we see an abandonment of the idea of macro societal guidance. Instead, the social order is the juggernaut, it's a runaway society, it's uncontrollable. Where we see almost a celebration of the demise of traditional groups, intermediary groups, classes, families, etc., that used to provide solidarity and support at an intermediary or micro level for people in general. And then right down at the micro level, so we have there a loss of both solidarity and subsidiarity. Then right down at the micro level, we have this strange rediscovery of the Parsonian notion of institutionalized individualism, of do-it-yourself biographies, of serial personal reinvention. And this gives you, you know, provisional man or pro-tem woman who cannot be held responsible for their actions because they may have reinvented themselves as somebody else by the time you try to hold them culpable. So they don't even fulfill the Habermasian brief of rendering accountable narratives of who they are and why they have done what they have done. They escape that kind of responsibility. Right, so to speed up a little bit, how are these models shaped the politics of modernity, of late modernity? Well, if we go back to the French revolutionary slogan, the two parts of it that have survived as politically foundational have been the liberty and the equality. What has fallen off the political agenda of Europe as a whole is fraternity. I could say the world as a whole. So in politics becoming based either upon the liberal or the labour conception, named in different ways in different countries, in this lib-lab oscillation of governments and governmental coalitions, we have the heritages of Hume and of Hobbes, respectively. But now what we are getting, I'll see whether this works. No? Well, never mind. Now what we are getting is the lib-lab alliance. No longer the oscillation, liberal, labour, coalition, first past the post, whatever, but the lib-lab consolidation representing the combined interests of market and state, which has the effect of completely absorbing civil society. Through market financialization of all activities, we used to have, and we still do have, multiple markets. We don't just have markets in monetary currency, but increasingly financialization turns every exchange into a market monetary exchange. Similarly, increasing bureaucratic state regulation, providing a performance indicator for everything, which of course reduces autonomy, as we know very well in the academy. The The more regulations our ministers of education impose upon us, the less freedom, let alone resources, we have to do our own research. So I want to move on, last 5 minutes, if that's okay. But the formula that is generated by the LibLab consortium, if you like, political formula, is one which represents a totalizing financialization of all activities, plus institutionalized individualism. The middle ground has been cleared. There is nothing between individuals and the state. If there is, the polity, the LibLab polity, would like to get rid of it. So monetary payment becomes the sole currency. You have, on the Lib side, a growth of public sector posts in order to provide services in the name of individual choice, or excellence for all, which is very much the Tony Blair third way political agenda, in conjunction with the Lab side of it, which is to increase welfare benefits of all kinds. Now, when you get this formula of these two things running together, governments become increasingly dependent upon banking services. And so you get an intensified, start at the left-hand side with intensified consumerism, which and then move across the top line, which increases the reliance upon banking, induces banks through the intensified calls that are made upon them and incomes that are received by them to take greater and greater risks in order to maximize their profits, which the Lab side of the LibLab Alliance encourages because it accepts as part of the residual redistributive justice theme that a growth in welfare expenditure is necessary and inevitable. And so along the bottom we get state redistribution, such as it is, augmenting private market consumption, and as this happens, the circle increases and you get further intensification of consumption. So when we get to this point, I think we should note that as far as consumption is concerned, there is nothing necessarily individualistic about it. People, there's some very good studies being done at the moment in Spain, about people doing ordinary things like the week's shopping, food shopping, grocery shopping. And the amount of reflexivity that has been shown still to go in to filling your shopping trolley, consideration of the family's tastes and objections to different foods, reflexive considerations of how you can combine these into a meal that will be acceptable to the whole family and therefore encourage commensality, which is important. These still exist, but increasingly we have a complete dissociation developing, a huge wedge being inserted between human consumption and human well-being. Now we all know this. We were brought up, even those who are very old, on the Vance Packard's Hidden Persuaders. We know how this has developed. We don't need to labour this. But I think there are one or two important additional things to add to that, and then I'll finish. Relations that previously prompted self-restraint, even in the post-war years, continued to prompt self-restraint and prompt saving. they did contain themselves. Very interesting series of interviews done Christmas 2007 among the already involuntarily unemployed in Britain. What is the worst thing about this recession and its consequential effect of unemployment for you? And the answer was, in many cases, I cannot buy my child 2,500 euros worth of Christmas presents. Secondly, you have a devaluation of personal skills. Nothing handmade is worth having. It has to have the mark. Which is why, in terms of skills, you know, one of the most important features about Western migration is how Eastern Europe filled the skills vacuum. And in short, you get a monetarization of self-esteem. Because one important question to ask ourselves is, why on earth would anybody wish to contract a mortgage which in terms of their earnings, they could not service? This is an illogical position for people to get themselves into, let alone to volunteer to find themselves in. And yet this is the, you know, without this human reaction, there would have been no such things as subprime mortgages. So I was going to go on, I'll just show it you, but I will not continue with it. I was going to continue to say how the social order is not the boss. We can't model it upon financial transactions. That money cannot in society remain the sole generalized medium of exchange other than by sacrificing both solidarity and subsidiarity. And that the thing sociologists, from my own personal position, should have contributed to the analysis of the crisis is a conception of civil society in late modernity, which is based upon the common good rather